Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Okay, guys, let's crack on. What an exciting evening it is. It's always interesting to be underneath a landslide, unless you're a Conservative politician, I guess. But it's been an absolutely seismic event electorally in the UK tonight, and we are going to explore some of the, if you like, media issues around this. That how did this happen? What did people know? And how might they have been influenced by external forces, if you like, by media, by social media, by the algorithms of the social networks out there? I've got a fantastic panel here today. They are an absolute brains trust around media and democracy. And obviously we're going to focus particularly on the UK election, because that has happened in a big way tonight. But I think it'd be really interesting, especially because we've got lots of international colleagues from different places tonight. So I think it's quite interesting to think about this in a comparative way as well. So I've got Judy Pesetti, who is the Professor of Journalism at City University, but has done so much in her life in a sort of activist and research and campaigning and journalistic way around issues around technology and news media and democracy. I've got Helen Margetts, who's from the Oxford Internet Institute and also works with the Alan Turing Institute, who is absolutely our research expert on computational journalism and more broadly the role of AI in society. And to my right, my colleague and friend Nick Anstead, who's a professor in the Department of Media and Communications, where he teaches and researches political communication. So my first question to you is, when you looked at this experience of the current British election, in a way, we were all told that there were going to be deep fakes. We were going to be told that the Russians would bot us to death in support of reform and so on. And yet it seems to have been rather not the AI election. Every election we're told, it's the Twitter election, it's the Facebook election.
Yeah.
And we were told this was going to be the AI election, but at least in the UK, it's not been, has it?
Well, I think it's clearly, as we were saying outside, the Chuck the Tories election. I mean, it's very much about a groundswell of discontent and a lack of trust in traditional political forces, that is, those that have been in power for the past 14 years. I wouldn't say there's been no evidence of concerns around AI and concerns of generative AI in particular, and concerns around bot networks. I mean, we have seen revelations through investigative journalism actually coming from both the ABC in Australia with reference to this election, and the BBC through its collaborations with data scientists from a variety of different universities and civil society organisations, where there has been some evidence of Russia aligned, I think is as far as you could go, certainly in terms of narrative capture, bot networks that have sought to, in some cases, in the case of five Facebook pages that the ABC was able to document in collaboration with computer scientists, promoting reform and denouncing both the Conservatives and the Labour Party. So, I mean, there is some evidence of this kind of behaviour, but it's certainly not been the kind of overwhelming kind of avalanche that was, I suppose, at the beginning of this year and at the end of last year, the subject of enormous concern. But I would caution that that doesn't mean this isn't an issue that is going to become more serious, as time goes on. I'll leave it there so that others can have their say. So I think you're right, to an extent, this has been very, very much less of an issue in the UK, but we're seeing evidence of it also surging in Global South countries, where I do a lot of research, so I'll come back to that.
Yeah, we'll definitely come back to that. Helen, can you give us a bit of a sense of what we know about the sort of structure of disinformation? What do we know about things like, micro-targeting, the Cambridge Analytica myth, that there was this kind of magical technology that would enable us to manipulate voters. What do we know about the structure around this?
Well, we know there's been a lot of hype, and this was certainly supposed to be kind of the... It was the year of the AI election. As well as being at Oxford, I lead a research programme at the Turing Institute, which is the National Institute for Data Science and AI. So I have a foot in both camps, the political science camp and the AI camp. And at the beginning of the year, all these computer scientists were kind of having symposia about AI and democracy. They didn't mean AI and democracy, of course. They meant AI and the next election in the country that they were in.
Right.
And so the UK was no exception, and it was going to be the AI election. I really think that it hasn't been, as you said. Even some of the bots, we're not really sure it was AI, because we've had bots for years. And although you can generate better bots and more bots with AI, it's not absolutely clear. But what I think it has been is the hype about AI election. I think we do have evidence for that, and I explain why. So there's sort of two key ways that AI, or well, I mean, two particular ways that AI, the latest generation of AI, is supposed to drive what people think and how they're influenced. So one of them is deep fakes. You mentioned that. And there just haven't been the kind of deep fakes that people expected. We haven't even seen anything as bad as we saw in the London election and the audio deep fake of Sadiq Khan talking about Palestine, which he himself said he thought was very dangerous. We haven't even really seen that. But what we have seen, so we had a survey came out yesterday, if anybody's interested. It's on X. Other social networks available. And what that showed was that around 15% of people report seeing a really harmful or pernicious deep fake, like child pornography or a financial fraud or scam, or a really kind of pernicious political deep fake like the Sadiq Khan one. 15% of people. But 90% of people are really worried, really concerned about deep fakes like that having a bad effect on all kinds of things, but particularly the political environment. So you've got this big mismatch between what people are experiencing and what they're worried about experiencing. And that's also true when you do when you look at hate speech and abuse, for example. I mean, another way the bots in particular can be used to generate hate and abuse. You see that far more people are really worried about it than experience it. And there are really worrying gender differences there as well, which I might talk about later. And then the other thing that AI was supposed to be really good for was highly targeted, pernicious micro-targeting. Sam Altman, the head of OpenAI, said that was going to destroy democracy, that kind of targeting, which is a bit rich coming from him. And there, I really think we haven't seen it. Micro-targeting is not great in this country. The political parties don't have the same sort of data that they have in the US, for example. The platforms have also tightened up on political targeting. They restrict political parties from targeting on too many characteristics, including the type of characteristics that are supposed to have been used in the Cambridge Analytica data, although in my view, there's absolutely no evidence that they made any difference at all, to be honest. We've also done some research at Oxford and the Turing showing that in experiments that the more attributes that you target on, it doesn't get any better. It doesn't get any more persuasive. That actually, even targeting with the kind of maximum number of attributes that you actually could is no more persuasive than the best message of GPT, the most commonly used chatbot. And that's interesting. It shows that the best message of GPT is very good, but it also suggests that targeting has been massively overhyped. And another reason why it's overhyped, I mean, or obviously all the political parties have been using political advertising. But a platform like TikTok, which is primarily used by younger people, so if you want to target younger audiences, it's the place to be. You can't, political advertising is not allowed. So you are, I mean, there are ways around that. But in general, politicians are reliant on kind of organic content of having built up a network. And that's not necessarily the people who have most desire to do the targeting. So, for example, on TikTok, the backbench Labour MP, Zara Sultana, has nearly 500,000. She has more TikTok followers than any of the other MPs. She also gets more hate than any of the other MPs, by the way, as a Muslim woman. So she's got 500,000 followers on TikTok and has a chance to sort of influence what's going on. Rishi Sunak, at least at the start of the campaign, had 14,000. So there's not a load you can do with that, really, to be honest, particularly with respect to targeting. So.
And just quick follow-up, just to sort of follow up some people who may not understand the difference between organic and other forms of traffic. The point is you see stories about, I saw a story today about there are a billion messages from Russian bots supporting reform. But they're just messages compared to organic shares where real people have actually messaged. So there's a difference. It's not just about the numbers, is it?
Yes, they haven't got lots of followers. They can sort of try and pass. I'm not saying they don't make a difference,
sure.
Bots. I mean, other research that one of my PhD students is doing is showing how bots do actually influence activist networks, like Black Lives Matter, for example, that they do have an effect on the conversation.
Yeah.
But yes, it's not all clicks are equal. Yeah.
Nick, we've heard that this may not be entirely the AI media election. What kind of media election was it?
Well, let me start by making the really important observation, which probably should be made at this point, which is that political science research will tell you that election campaigns do not matter, or they matter only in the most minimally, statistically insignificant way. So what does matter, what matters probably, are what we would call fundamentals. So let me give you the single most important fundamental in this election, which is that real wages in Britain haven't grown since 2008. Right. If you want to understand what's going on, this seems to be a pretty good starting point. You might also look at the type of coalition the Conservatives assembled in 2019, which turned out to be deeply unstable. You might look at the sort of things that Tim Bale was talking about the institutions that select party leaders. Now, this doesn't make communication unimportant, but communication has to, and by communication I mean legitimate and illegitimate, has to exist within the structures created by those fundamentals.
Yeah.
So, if you like, it's a way of turning the question round. Instead of saying, what's the impact of this political communication, we might say, how do we situate it within the circumstances created by this fundamental? So let me give you one example of this. The Conservative Party have, I think, pretty objectively run a rubbish communication campaign. And that's sort of not their fault, because what they've done is they've kept looking for a message that sticks, or a message that has some kind of traction, but that makes them appear very inconsistent, very unstable, right? So simultaneously, the Labour Party is this terrible ideological threat to your family's well-being, but they are also a party that has no beliefs.
Yeah.
And that seems entirely contradictory, but actually it isn't, if you think of this as just a desperate attempt to find some kind of message that has any kind of traction in a set of political circumstances that are essentially unmanageable for a party in office. So that seems to me one way of understanding that the situation that we've seen in communicative terms. Let's flip that round to the Labour Party. So one of the things I think that you will probably hear people saying about the Labour Party is, have they said very much? And of course the answer is they haven't really said very much. And that might have ramifications in the future, which maybe we can we can talk about later as well. But it's been a manifestation of what's been termed this Ming Vase strategy, which is the Roy Jenkins soundbite about Tony Blair, that he's like a man carrying a priceless Ming Vase across a slippery, shiny floor. And this, of course, is the kind of situation that Labour has been in. They've wanted to make themselves a smaller target as possible, so the way to do that is to say as little as possible. So if you like, that seems to me the defining characteristic of this campaign, is parties struggling to cope with things that were already very fixed.
But this is quite disappointing, right? Because you're a poll comms professor, right? And you're telling me that this is one of the least mediated elections we've seen for ages, where the media, social media, mainstream media, has been pretty unimportant, actually. And in a way, that might be a good thing. Might be a wonderful thing, I don't know.
No, I'm not saying it's unimportant. I'm just saying it doesn't have effects, or to me it seems that there isn't much evidence. And by the way, of course, one of the interesting things about this conversation is we're doing sort of hot takes, if you like. We don't have evidence, but what we have is pre-existing evidence. Yeah. That those communications don't change the result, but doesn't make them unimportant, right? So let's take the example of Labour again. Labour have developed a strategy that's been very conducive to winning an election, clearly, but what does that strategy then signify about the kind of mandate they've won to do things later on? Will that have lasting impacts? So I wouldn't at all say it's unimportant, but what I would say it's the creation of a wider set of factors.
Okay. Judy, like you, I travel the world, and people, you know, they laugh about, they say, oh, you're worried about deepfakes. We're worried about being shot in the head. We're worried about our newsroom being shut down when we're trying to cover election. But also, we're very worried in very marginal places, unstable places, about the overwhelming power of people who are able to use new technologies to message in a way that might shift an election campaign in particular, but also just a general. How does that work, and what are the kind of technologies involved?
Okay, so I work part of the time for City University, where I'm a professor of journalism, and the other half of my working life is being the head of research for the International Centre for Journalists, which ICFJ, as it's known by its acronym, which is a DC-based international NGO focused on independent media development and also issues connected with the safe and free practice of journalism. And so my research over the past, particularly over the past decade, has focused on threats that journalists face in their work, so from physical safety to digital security threats to targeted online violence, as we term it, which includes very specifically gendered disinformation as a feature. And this is the environment in which journalists and human rights defenders are operating, not just in countries that we have typically considered to be high-risk environments, which is what you're referring to, for journalists and news organisations to operate, you know, in authoritarian states. The problem we have is that we do have a global tilt towards authoritarianism. This night is unusual in the current scheme of international politics.
Well done, Britain, for a change.
And I don't think you can separate the ways in which algorithmic clustering, for example, has driven more extreme conduct and which has been considered to be central to events such as the massacre of Rohingya in Myanmar. I mean, that is an argument that the UN is considering. So, based on fairly extensive investigations. So all this is to say that in the work that I do, in the places where I do research and where I'm connected to journalists who are very much under fire, threatened with death, threatened with rape, threatened with imprisonment in very real contexts, and the whole time trying to do accountability reporting, particularly in the context of elections. So I'm talking about places like the Philippines, South Africa, Georgia, and elsewhere. What I'm saying is that I don't mock people's concern about generative AI and deepfakes, because their concern is based on a fear that these tools could make it more likely that they are going to be subject to the kind of violence that they already have experienced. So the physical threat is paramount, but they don't discount the function of the abuse of these kinds of technologies and the ways in which the international community has failed to ensure safeguards around them. So they are concerned. I mean, I've just come back from South Africa, where I was working embedded in a news organisation called Daily Maverick, which is one of the last remaining truly independent investigative outlets. It's an amazing outlet. So I was there for nearly 3 weeks in the lead up to the election. And the women journalists there in particular are targeted in very virulent ways. And while we aren't necessarily going to say they're bot networks, there are inauthentic actors, as the platforms would label them, who have formed networks, probably interspersed with bot networks, that have been in operation in various ways over the past 6, 7, 8 years. And there is evidence, according to the investigative work that the journalists have done in collaboration with computer scientists and digital forensics agencies in South Africa, that the bot networks, loose term, but the networks of bad faith actors, possibly intermingled with bot networks, that were previously targeting those journalists and targeting vulnerable communities when Jacob Zuma was being held to account, have in the past 12 months reappeared. Some of those same accounts have reappeared in ways that appear to be orchestrated, once again supporting MK, which is the sort of populist left party in South Africa, which Zuma has, although he can't stand for election, has been able, is the fourth, is the face of and is the leader of this party. And so they're able to see the way these bot networks are operating, and they are interspersing the attempts to discredit the journalists and the outlets and the human rights organisations, the civil society organisations, and interspersing that with disinformation about a free and fair election and with pro-Kremlin narratives. Yeah. So, I mean, a lot more work needs to be done to establish exactly what's going on there. But the point of this answer is to say that I don't think we can separate, the physical threats anymore from the digital threats, and we have to be quite sophisticated in our understanding. And yeah, so I'll leave it there.
Yeah, absolutely. If you talk to any female journalist online, you can't separate the two.
It's horrific.
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Helen, I'm interested in, I guess you can't talk about the effects, because it's incredibly difficult to measure the effects of this kind of technologic-driven or human-driven disinformation or manipulation. But I wonder, what can you tell about how effective it is just in, technologically? I mean, we see stories about, millions of bots and so on, but how do you understand how it is actually operationalized? How do you understand how it actually works? And not just in the UK election, but, more broadly.
Well, I think we tend to think of the social media platforms as kind of really, we tend to think of them as really monolithic. I think we think like that because they're so huge.
Yeah.
But they're actually operating incredibly different ways in different countries. We are very insulated from that here because the platforms don't like getting involved in politics, and they particularly don't like getting involved in British politics. Even Putin said, didn't he, that he wasn't going to bother with this election. He was going to wait for the US one. Seriously, talking about the platforms, I think the problem is we think that they behave the same everywhere, but they don't. Their content moderation strategies are much more effective and strict here. They're also just better because they're much more automated than they were, and they have developed very sophisticated ways to classify and detect and to counter things like hate speech and abuse and some of the other things that you were talking about.
Can I just jump in very quickly there, just to say that's really interesting because, you know, I was reading about this, that perhaps it could be that the tech companies are getting better at this. Are they just getting better at it for a UK election?
Yes, well, that's what I was going to say. Sorry. They have got much better at it. I can't remember the exact percentages, but when I first started working in this area a few years ago, it was like 20% of hate speech was classified automatically. Now it's much more like 80 or above, above 80, 90. But that's in kind of English-speaking countries or countries where there's a language that's very widely spoken, where there are strong states, and where there are weak states, and where there are languages that are not spoken by so many people, it's a very different story, and the content moderation strategies are much less effective. And that, I think, in part, is what allows this big variation across countries.
They're much less invested in trying to protect people. In those
much less. You know, they got caught out in Myanmar, but there are literally hundreds of other countries where they could easily be caught out. And I think, you know, when you look at countries like, I don't want to pick on one country, but I mean, you know, Romania, for example, where there is huge, where bots have just kind of totally infested the information environment.
And you've got Andrew Tate and his misogynistic networks.
Andrew Tate there. Yeah. I mean, you've really got a problem. And I think the thing that we should worry about most, or the thing I'm worried about most, kind of for future elections, because, as I said, this key election that we're talking about tonight isn't one of them. But the danger is, and it's connected what I said at the beginning about the hype, that is, if everyone's so worried about misinformation and worried about AI and worried that nothing is kind of true, and even things even the sort of chatbots that are supposed to help, like Microsoft Copilot, are always putting health warnings and things and saying it may be wrong. So you've got this situation where people might not believe anything. And then you've got the problem, how do you get out good information, like information about voter ID and where the election is and where it isn't, and what the date of the election, you know, and those are the things that become vulnerable. And that's something to worry about.
We are
about.
Spinning on this, aren't we? I mean, I led the LSE's Commission on the Information Crisis back in 2018, and, you know, it was, the conclusion was basically, Nick was a part of this, and we basically sort of said, something must be done, something is wrong here, but it's moving so fast. And that anything you do to try and counter that, if you try and restrict, you know, the messaging, then the danger is that there's going to be a kind of rebound effect, that people are going to fear that you're censoring them. You know, for example, that it's an incredibly difficult space to actually intervene in. And we can observe it, we can describe it and try to understand it, but to intervene is really difficult, right? I mean, neither of you have got ready-made answers.
No, sorry, you haven't said anything for a while.
I'm coming to Nick in a minute. Okay. I'm not good.
But I firmly believe that, I mean, we operate here in a country where hate speech is, certain elements of hate speech are still, you know, technically, they're not criminalised, but, you know, they are forbidden.
Yeah.
And they should be implemented. And yet, I mean, I work studying just women journalists around the world who are constantly threatened with rape, being, quote, shot in the pussy was a recent one that a South African journalist was exposed to. And that's the sort of, I mean, the problem we have is that content, I think the problem we have is that kind of content should be able to be moderated and through detection, you know, limited and removed, but still they are getting, when they can get through to anybody at a company, they're told this is within the boundaries of appropriate speech. And I do think certainly, you know, there's ongoing research, but there is deep concern about the ways, for example, in which misogyny, which is, I would argue, a form of hate speech, which is not always recognised as a form of hate speech in countries around the world, but it is, is spreading at such a rate and with such effect that it's linked. So the function of these platforms and the manipulation of these platforms by misogynists, it's linked with the rollback of gender rights in countries around the world. Yeah. And so I think, you know, we can say yes, there is a concern about people feeling that they are being censored. It's a very kind of free speech absolutist kind of First Amendment approach to things. And in the case of, say, misogyny, we, you know, men, this is the sort of first argument is you can't suppress my free speech. I'm entitled to say she's an ugly bitch. And, yeah, you know, so I'm a little kind of antagonized by the you're censoring me argument, because when you are allowing unfettered speech of that kind, and you accept it as the norm, then what you are essentially doing is facilitating the suppression of the freedom of expression and the particular right of, say, a woman journalist to do her job protected under international law. And is that the outcome you want from the argument? So it's complex, but...
Absolutely, it's complex. Nick, bringing it back home, broadly, if it's not the AI election, what has it been in the media election? And please get your questions ready next.
Okay, so let me make two really quick points then that I think that are potentially interesting in terms of thinking about the media election. It absolutely wasn't the TV debate election.
Really?
I think once again they fit into this point that you can't escape the constraints that you're operating in within as a politician, and you saw politicians struggling to articulate lines that actually move the dial in any way. Mm. I also think, you know, you had a debate with two party leaders given a platform, and it seems that these parties have got about 60% of the vote between them. So whether that format would survive into a future election, I think, is an open question. The other thing I think I will just mention, just since we were talking about regulatory challenges, and I think this is a very open question, maybe we could think of it as the GB News election, given that one of their presenters looks very likely to be elected as an MP in a few hours' time. Wow. And obviously the idea of
Who are you talking about?
Mr. Farage.
Oh, that. Sorry, oh, yeah, of course. Nigel. I forgot he was still a presenter.
Most of their presenters are going to lose their seats, aren't they?
Well, that's true. They're going to lose some of their seats. But the idea is someone being elected as a party leader, of course, is an interesting dimension to that. And I think that there's a question there, you know, both for Reform, what its relationship with Reform will be, and also what role it's going to play in a, you know, potential Conservative Party civil war. And also regulators, I think, really did get a handle on how to handle a partisan TV network, and that's a big challenge.
But basically, you agree that... I mean, my thesis is that TV was the most influential media. Anyway, leave that for now. Any questions, please, from the audience? Sorry.
You're such troopers. I would not have stayed around to hear us, but thank you.
Hey, Julie. So
sorry.
Don't undersell yourself.
Hi, it's Please go ahead. Ella thank Bennett. I'm just wondering, why is it so difficult to regulate the social media platforms and the way that they moderate hate online?
Well, we do at last have the Online Safety Act, and it's now an act. I mean, and... You know, it, in spite of all the things that happened to it and all the other things that were hung on it, as well as moderating social media platforms, I mean, it is a path-breaking piece of legislation, and it is going to make a difference. And the regulator, I mean, AI is a real challenge for regulators, and Ofcom has really tooled up. I mean, they do have a really impressive array of expertise. So... You know, it's not impossible, but obviously it's a hugely difficult thing to do for all the reasons that we've been talking about. And in some countries, kind of seemingly, impossible. And of course, some social media companies, I mean, some social media companies are trying to do something about it. Because of reputational damage more than anything else. Yeah. But some social media companies have completely stopped trying to do anything about it, like X. I mean, I think X is a potentially sort of worrying sign of the future since it became X, because it's just sort of trying to do all your worst fears, really, as a platform. and trying to allow the things that you might want to regulate.
And you had ideas about, specifically around elections and politics, about how you might regulate political communications.
Well, I mean, with the caveat that it's really hard to regulate these platforms at the best of times. It's even harder to regulate them in an electoral period because the stakes are so much, much higher. And traditionally, the regulatory instrument that has tended to be used is control of expenditure. So what you're doing is you're limiting the expenditure that parties are going to make. But it's interesting, we kind of sort of moved into a new era almost by accident. So if you look in the United Kingdom, historically we've had a ban on the most powerful common form of commercial advertising, which was television advertising. Now parties can spend with reckless abandon on social media, and we haven't even had a conversation about whether this is a good idea. So maybe we just even need to start having the conversations about what role these platforms play in our democracy. I just wanted to make one other point about X as well that I think is a difference in this election that we haven't had. And one really good way of understanding what's happening, maybe not regulating exactly, but shaping these platforms, is to have a vibrant civil society that can research and understand what's going on in them. And of course, one of the things that's happened in the move from Twitter to X is the API has been shut down. Yeah. So we are flying, we are blinder in terms of what's happening on these platforms than we've ever been.
Or we have to be very independently wealthy in order to afford the $45,000 a month it costs you to access the API. So, can I...
Just to very quickly answer your question, it's the way you access data. So historically on Twitter, you could access very large amounts of data for very little or no money at all and use that for research purposes. Musk has shut that down.
Yeah, and none of the other platforms really have a proper equivalent, so that is a huge problem.
Which is the main problem. We don't know what they're doing.
And we have Meta that is going to shut down it wasn't close to a Twitter API kind of amazing fire hose where you could get all of the data that you wanted in real time and then analyse it. But Meta has a platform or a tool called CrowdTangle, which allows at least some research capability in terms of detecting, through natural language processing analysis, for example, on the text in comments. It's less specific than the API that Twitter had, but it allows for some research and some kind of network analysis and trends detection. They are shutting that down at the end of August. So I actually think what we have is a situation where we have Elon Musk, who has abrogated all responsibility and bragged about doing so, and has dismissed his safety and trust teams. I think he's given cover to the other actors in this space to actually downgrade their attention on this issue. So access to data is one important issue, and as colleagues said, we now have here the Online Harms Act, and in Europe there's the DSA, which is another act that is being tested. But one of the things we have to ensure is that through those acts we are able to effectively secure access as independent researchers and civil society organisations and even news organisations where there are appropriate ethical standards adhered to. Because if we can't assess what they're doing independently, then we've lost any power that we have.
I think I can take one more question right in the middle there.
My question is for you. You mentioned that the Conservative Party didn't contextualize, as you said, their communication strategy and the constraints that they were operating in. So my question is, what would you have done if you were running the Conservatives?
Oh, that's a really good question.
I think with the caveat, I don't think they could have done anything. I think the situation they put themselves in, but I think they made a situation worse. So, for example, I think one of the things that will be misinterpreted tomorrow morning is this will be considered to be about ideology, that the Tories should have been more right-wing. We're already hearing this line. That's not true. They should have been more competent. Yeah. So for example, what Sunak should have done is he should have voted to chuck Johnson out of Parliament when the penalty was imposed on him for lying to Parliament. He should have made a clean break with his predecessors. He didn't do that. He looked weak, and this is where he's ended up.
There is an English phrase for this. Where are you from?
Argentina.
I don't know how this would sound in Spanish. There's an English phrase for this, and I can't think of a polite way of saying it. So anybody who's going to be offended, close your ears right now. But there's an English phrase which is, you cannot polish a turd. You know? If something is shit, it's shit, you know? And I think, I don't mean to say that in an offensive way or a prejudicial way or an ideological way, but if your record is terrible, there's a limit to media. I'm a media professor, I'm a journalist, you know, I've lied my way through all sorts of things. You know,
Charlie!
I'm sure you guys haven't, but you know, you try to spin it, you try to shape things, but in the end, when you're, you know, whatever the phrase is, your trousers are down or whatever, then sometimes it's impossible to do it. But that is a lovely hypothetical, isn't it? I think you should do that with your students next year. Could you have run the Conservative campaign better? Well, you could have done by not having the rain, you know,
there
for
was
example.
The leaving of the D-Day commemoration.
Leaving the D-Day thing, that wasn't a great idea. You know, there were lots of bad mistakes, but in the end, I think it was just circumstance. Yeah.
Do not complain about not having Sky TV. That was another one.
We've run out of time. Oh. I'm told we've run out of time. So thank you very, very much to my fantastic panel.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favourite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.